Domenico Fiorini, who will be talking on the notion of super selection.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to this conference. It's a bit exciting place. I really enjoyed it so far. I have to apologize for the lousy quality of the transparency. But it happened that the blue ink sort of evaporated over the eyes and I had to redraw everything a bit. It doesn't add to the visibility of the dangle. Okay, so the task I set to my talk is to give you an introduction to the notion of super selection rules. I say here in quantum theory, quantum field theory, and also in coherence theory. I will start with some generalities, basically some very brief historical remarks about the super selection rules were first proposed. I take some time to give you the algebraic definition that's now standard in quantum field theory, and then I point out what the relation is between superselection rules and symmetries. And I also briefly mention some examples, basically the univalent superselection rule, which is the superselection rule separating half-integer spin from integer spin states. Then the mass superselection rule in quantum mechanics, which is sort of just a model, and we know that non-relativistic quantum mechanics is not the end of the story, but it's an interesting case where you can study the arguments. And I make some brief remarks, unfortunately brief remarks, I will not talk more about this, but this permits my time, on the charge superselection in quantum electron dynamics. And I end with some brief opinions on the existence or non-existence of superselection rules. So let me start with the generalities. Superselection rules were first introduced in 1952 by Wick, Whiteman, and Wigner, a paper that's usually referred to as 3 times W. They proposed the following. They considered Hilbert spaces of states with half integer and integer angular momentum. So the plus sign is for integer and the minus sign is for half integer. Including spin, of course. Then the total space of all these states is the direct sum. And 3 times W asserted that the diagonal vectors in that vector space, that is, those vectors which do not lie either in this subspace or this subspace, but then a diagonal in that space, cannot correspond to pure physical states. And the argument was based on time-reversed invariance. And I'm not going to go into this proof, it's a very elementary proof, but the basic statement is, or the statement is, that even though you have the direct sum of two Hilbert spaces, certain superpositions do not correspond to pure physical states. In contradicting the general validity of the superposition principle. An alternative and perhaps more modern proof rests on SO3 invariance, and I really mean SO3, not SU2, SO3 invariance. And we are set to below, but actually on not. So the proof uses SL3 invariance, and that superselection rule between integer and half integer angular momentum states became known as a superselection rule of Julie Baylor. In that paper in 1952, Wick, Whiteman, and Wigner also suggested by global gauge invariants, so rigid gauge invariants, you should be able to prove rigorously that there is a charged supersymmetry. I mean, this was gifted in there, but of course, there was no rigorous proof. And they suggested for the first time that invariance principles, a symmetry principle, could allow you to rigorously prove the existence of supersymmetry. The actual proof in quantum field theory of the charged supersymmetry rule was then done by Strozzi and Weidmann in 1974.
Much further than we can reach.
So charged supersymmetry was proved in a sense under some hypotheses by Strozzi. Now, according to Weidmann and Wigner, superselection rules are strict inhibitions of the superposition principle based on symmetry principles, at least in the examples they look at. And they are eventually theories. So you can't argue about those themes. They are theories based on very fundamental assumptions about the kinematic properties in theory. So that means that the superposition principle cannot be fundamentally valid. And that's, of course, a blow to the very foundations of quantum mechanics, of which the superposition principle is perhaps the most characteristic feature. And then you can ask, is that really true? Do we have to accept that quantum mechanics on a very fundamental level does break its very characteristic feature of being along the superposition principle? So let me make a few more alternative statements out of the state superselection rule. And I'm, for simplicity, I'm restricting attention to the discrete case, meaning that I have direct sums of Hilbert spaces rather than direct integrals, which is just a technicality and doesn't matter. So let H be a Hilbert space that's a direct sum of Hilbert spaces, and the matrix runs over subset M, and consider the orthogonal projectors from the Hilbert space to these subspaces. Then the statement of a superselection rule between these sectors, so given by these orthogonal decomposition, are as follows. There are four alternatives that I present. One is that any physical density matrix rho satisfies the following inequality, namely that sort of it lives to the different in the different sector separately. So you multiply by the projector, then you apply the density matrix, and then you project again, and then you start with roll M. And what you get is identical to the density matrix. So if you put in a pure state, then it's just saying that the pure array of the pure state lies entirely within one of these orthogonal components. That's, of course, the same thing as saying any physical density matrix row commutes with all the projectors. So the projectors lie, and I come to that, lie into the... commutes with the rows. But you can have a dual definition. By rather than talking about states, we talk about observables. And in quantum mechanics, you can do this because there's a certain pairing between observables and states given by the expectation value. So there's a duality relation. You can either talk about states or you can talk about observables. And so if O, kernel O, denotes the set of observables which you can without loss of generality make into an algebra, then any element of the algebra of observables, which I view as a subset of the algebra of bounded operators on a Hilbert space, which you can also do without loss of generality, because if you had an unbounded operator, you can always take a bounded function of it. Then this, an equivalent statement is that any observable obeys that relation that we already saw with the density matrix. So any observable of K can be first projected to the subspace, then you act with an observable, and then you reflect back.
That's true.
And then perhaps the most useful statement for quantum field theory, which is still equivalent, is the following, that the algebra of observables is the commutative in B of H, in the algebra of bounded operators on H, with respect to the set of orthogonal projectors. And the commutant means that you take all bounded operators and you take those bounded operators which commute with the orthogonal projectors. And that's the same as saying that set is the commutant of that set. And now, because we talked about bounded operators, the commutant is another variable.
Otherwise, it comes to metaphor.
And that last definition leads me to what's known as the algebraic formulation of superselection rules. So the algebraic theory of superselection rules starts from a very abstract starting point where you associate your system with so-called C-star algebra, and then you represent this C-star algebra as an algebra of operators in some Hilbert space, where they become bounded operators, and then you get a subset of the set of bounded operators, which you then call your the representation of your C-star algebra, and that becomes what's called the von Neumann algebra and so forth. I don't want to go into this. Having done the first few steps in the algebraic approach, you do end up with what's called a von Neumann algebra, a star algebra where you have the edge oriented star operation, which is a bound, which is a subset of the algebra of bounded operators on some Hilbert space. So imagine you're given an O, that lies in B of H. And in the algebraic way of thinking, states are now defined as normalized positive linear functionals on that O. So given an O, you can find states on it. And out of some mild mild technical assumptions, all states are given by density matrices. So you can think of a state always being given, so if you take the expectation value of A in the state row, then it's the trace of A times row. It can be done, as I said, under some mild assumption. And the statement of the existence of a superselection rule in that system given to you by O is just the statement that O has a non-trivial center. So you have elements different from the identity which do commute with all elements of O. That's the statement of a superselection rule. And you can possibly see. You can probably see that this is just what I had in this last option, where you have the projectors of the invariant subspaces that lie in the center of the observables. So the center of O is O intersected with the commutant of O, that is, all elements that commute with Earth. That's the center of O. And I wrote it down again, what I mean by this prime, O prime. The set of all B in the set of bounded operators of A, H, such that they commute with all elements of A. All elements of O. So all elements in B of H that commute with O are the formula commutant of O. The self-adjoint elements in the center are then called superselection observables. But if you, in this algebraic business, you have observables and they form an algebra, but not any element in the algebra of observables is really an observable. It's just called the algebra of observables, because you take all observables, all self-adjoint elements, and then you generate from that an algebra, just by multiplying them together, adding them together. But by multiplying two self-adjoint operators, you do usually get something that's not self-adjoint. but the cells are joined elements in that hydrogen molecule, and he can define by that. So for the meanings, you can just assume that it's the electronics. That's philosophy. Now, okay, you know, and given that it has a notional center, then you can look for the projection operators in that sense. And according to the projection operators, then you can decompose H as a direct sum or a direct integral of Hilbert spaces. That's the most general statement. And just to indicate that you don't need to have a direct sum usually, I just write a direct integral. And so you have some measure space, which makes it R, and then you integrate a whole lot of Hilbert spaces, continuous tables. The difference between a direct integral and a direct sum is, of course, that in a direct integral, an integrand, a single, infinitely thin Hilbert space, does not form a subspace. Subspaces, closed subspaces, are always given by integrals over some measurable set. So there's always a finite thickness. Otherwise, there's no real difference. Now, the vectors in that direct integral Hilbert space H are now sort of square integral functions over that ladle space, over that measure space. So you have an assignment of a vector in this internal Hilbert space H of lambda for each sort of fiber standing over this ladle space. With an assignment to each base point, we assign a vector in the fiber over there. And that assignment should be square integral. So if you take the inner product of two such vectors for each lambda, and then you integrate over lambda, then it should converge. Likewise, elements in the algebra observables are now assignments of bounded operators in each kernel in each sort of fiber Hilbert space over the vector. So it's an assignment for each lambda, you can make an A of lambda, which lies in the set of bounding operators in that internal fiber Hilbert space. And the action on that of things, the action of those observables on states is just defined by if you take A, you add an F, and you evaluate it at the base of lambda, then it's just A of lambda times F of lambda. That's being defined because that's from this function. Now comes the definition of selection. Two states, F1 and F2, are said to be separated by a super selection rule, or equivalent to one space, if they are disjoint. That's the same thing. If they have disjoint support as L2 functions over this label set. Right? If you have this direct integral decomposition of your Hilbert space, and then you take functions over this space into the internal Hilbert spaces, and if two functions as L2 functions have disjoint support, then you say they are disjoint or separated by this set. And that means that these two functions are not only orthogonal, they are of course orthogonal because they have disjoint support. But it also means that F1 times A acted on F2 is zero for all A element O. So no element in the algebra of observables can make you measure a correlation between these. They always stay orthogonal, it's totally separate. And that's the same that is the same. So it stays orthogonal even if you have all possible observables. Certainly, super selection rules express a certain mismatch between the Hilbert space and the algebra of observables. It seems that H has been chosen too large, or that O, the observable, has been chosen too small. You can ask the question, in all the electric textbooks of quantum mechanics, that at some stage you are allowed to choose a maximal commuting set of observables. And if you take the eigenvalues of these maximal commuting set of observables, one ray is selected. So that means that the algebra of observables is large enough to fix a ray. And you can ask, under what conditions is that still true in the presence of superselection rules? Because as I just said, this mismatch expresses for given age, for example, that O is too small. If O is dramatically too small, then you wouldn't be even able to fix a ray, because the number of observations that you are allowed to do with this O is too small. The statement is not that always in the presence of superselection rules, you will not be able to fix a ray. And we ask the question, under what conditions can you do that? So, we ask under what conditions is going big enough, such that observations will suffice to interpret the maximum. In other words, when can we satisfy the so-called Dirac requirement that there exists a maximally commuting set of observables? Maximal meaning sufficient to fix a ray. And the answer in that approach is that the algebra of observables, which lies in V of H, should admit a maximal abelian subalgebra. And maximal abelian subalgebra A, the term maximal refers always not to be maximal in O, but maximal in V of H. Because a maximal abelian subalgebra in O always exists. You can always sort of take an abelian subalgebra and add elements to it until you reach a maximal one, and then you stop. But that is not necessarily maximal in V of H. If you make it maximal in V of H, it might grow outside O. And the question is, when is it maximal in V of H and still in O? That's the multiple task. And so the maximal in abelian means in algebraic terms, this subalgebra has to be contained in this commutator, which is just expressing the fact that it's abelian. Because it means that that A is contained in the set of all elements that commute with A, obviously, because it's abelian. And it has also be maximal, that means A prime, the commutating section, contained in it. Because if it weren't, if the set of all commuting elements with A would not be contained in A, then there would be another one which you could add to it and could make it bigger. But you want it to be maximal. So maximality is just the inverse of tradition. And so maximal abelian means that A equals A prime. So in algebraic terms, Dirac's requirement amounts to saying, it's equivalent to, there exists a maximal abelian A in O. So there exists an A such that A equals A prime. Under that condition, the observations in O suffice to fix the ray. And of course that's a restriction that on the smallness of O. It must contain a subalgebra that's abelian and maximal in V of H. So O can't be too small. So let me give you some other equivalent formulations of Dirac's requirement, because it's important. Another one is that there exists a cyclic vector, that you can find a vector in a little space, such that acting on that vector G with all elements of A in O gives you a set of vectors which lie dense in H. That's an alternative definition. I'm not going to prove it, but it's a And the third equivalent notion is very interesting. And in order to make it, I have to make a few preliminary remarks. The set of elements in V of H that commute with O, i.e. the commutator of O, is sometimes called the gauge algebra. Because it's that part of the algebra V of H that commutes with everything that you observe. You can think of this algebra O prime is being generated by its unitary elements. That's always true for Illuminati, right? So without loss of generality, you can see the force being generated by unitary elements. Now take these unitary elements as elements, and now consider them as group elements. So you're allowed to multiply them together, but you're not allowed to add them. So we are now on the level of a group, not an algebra. Forget about plus, just multiply. Then this unitary elements generate a group, and that's called the gauge group. And that is, in fact, what you usually, in the algebraic setting, what you usually call the gauge group of a polynomial system. It is easy to see that because the algebra is generated by unitary elements, that the group is abelian if the gauge algebra is. So one is abelian if and only if the other is abelian. So that's important. And now you can make, having made the statement, now you can make another equivalent statement about Dirac's requirement. Dirac's requirement holds if and only if the gauge group is abelian. And the proof that from the old statement A, i.e. having a maximal abelian subalgebra 2 being abelian, so the gauge group is abelian, that's kind of easy, that's what I want to show you. And the reverse proof is more difficult than that. So assume you have a maximal abelian subalgebra A, and want to prove that the gauge group of O is abelian. In other words, that O prime is abelian. Now A is a subalgebra of O, so we have that inclusion. Taking the commutant of an inclusion relation reverses the inclusion relation, because if something is bigger, its commutant is smaller. So taking the commutant of both sides says that O prime contains A prime. The A prime hypothesis is equal to A, and A prime hypothesis lies inside O. So that says that O prime lies inside O. But O being a, that's a technical thing now, O being a phenomenal number is equal to its double commutant. That's true for all phenomena. You take the double commutant, the commutant of the commutant, you are back to where you started. So O is equal to O prime. So that says O prime is contained in O double. But if something is contained in its primed version, that statement just means that the something is abelian. So O prime is abelian. And this is what we wanted to prove. So Dirac's requirement is true if and only if the gauge algebra, the gauge algebra, the gauge algebra is abelian. So that's the statement that you find in many algebraic approaches. Now the question is, where did superselection come from in the first place? This is just a statement how you state the existence of something. Where did they come from? At the most, I mean, as indicated by the historical remarks, the most powerful way to derive them is by imposing symmetry requirements. And let me remind you that in quantum mechanics, the symmetry means that you can implement the group as a unitary or anti-unitary ray representation on the Hilbert space. That's the theorem of thinking. So, and it's very important that you have ray representations and not proper representations. You do not need in quantum mechanics to have proper representations. Ray representations are sufficient. But if you do have non-trivial ray representations, this amounts in many cases to the existence of superselection. And let me indicate one story. So suppose there's a symmetry group G, that means you implement G as, say, unitary ray representations. So that means for each element G, small g and capital G, you have an element, a unitary matrix U of G, such that if you multiply U of G1 and U of G2 together, you do get U of G1 times G2, up to a phase factor which depends on the elements. Right? That's called the multiplier of these ray representations. Associativity of that action on G on the space of rays requires that these multipliers satisfy a certain relation. Given here. Now, these multipliers, or these U's, are only defined up to a certain redefinition. Given U as a function on G, you could just as well modify view by multiplying each of the old views by some phase vector depending on G. That phase vector is just a function. It's not required to be continuous or anything. It's just a set theoretic function. And that is important because the only thing you want to require is smoothness on the space of rays, not on the space of vectors. So this can be any function you like. So the new prime of G is the old view of G times phase vector. So that is function phase vector in from G in the space of the phases. If to the redefinition of the use, then the omega multiplies both vectors. And the omega is also getting defined by that. The omega goes to omega prime, and basically you multiply by 5g1 and 2, and by the inverse 5g1 and the inverse of 5g2. Then you get defined. Now comes the note, the important notion that many methods similarity, two multipliers are called similar if and only if a phi exists, such a redefinition function exists, to that transforms one of these omegas. And that's an equivalence relation. And the ray representation is called the non-trivial ray representation if you can't modify the multiplier omega in such a way that you make it identical to one. Because then we have a proper representation. And the remark is just a mathematical remark. These multipliers are classified by a certain group cohomology. Second group cohomology in the coefficients of the world. So you can, in principle, calculate and classify these possible inequivalent multiples. Now the basis, all the derivations of superselection rules from symmetry requirements is this. So, basis of all the derivations of superselection rules is from the theory. Given two ray representations, they can be sub-representations of a larger ray representation in which these two subspaces are embedded, if and only if they have similar multipliers. If you have two ray representations whose multipliers are not similar, then you will never be able to find a larger space which also carries representation, of which these two are sub-representations. And the proof is effective, very easy. The argument for the existence of a superselection rule is then based on the hypothesis of a definite symmetry. That's very important. The star is for which events, a certain symmetry rule should be implementable on all possible state physical fields. And then by Wigner's theorem, symmetry means ray representation, and then ray representation means that you can apply this theorem. The Wigner's theorem ensures you that all symmetry, symmetries are dimensional by ray representations. So the statement then is, if H1 and H2 carry ray representations, U1, omega 1, and, it should be U2, U2, omega 2 of G, respectively, where omega 1 and omega 2 are not similar, then H1 plus H2 cannot carry any ray representation of G. Hence, it would violate your requirement that any physical state space should carry a ray representation of your selected symmetry group. Hence, states in H1 plus H2 cannot correspond to physical states. That's what all these proofs based on symmetry. If you think in terms of rays rather than vectors, then you could say P means the space of rays, so the space of rays in depth, the space of physical rays. So it means the space of physical rays and the direct sum of physical spaces would then be just the union of rays in one subspace and the rays in the other subspace. No diagonal ray would be allowed. So that would be the large subspace, just the union on which the symmetry could act, either on this subspace or that subspace. But it could not act in any diagonal way. And that's precisely the statement of the single symmetry, that no superpositions are one. This is just how you would add in classical state spaces. Now, of course, the consequence of this reasoning and the corresponding, and hence the corresponding superselection rule, can be avoided if one is prepared to say, well, quantum mechanically, we have an enlargement of the symmetry pool. If you change your mind about what the fundamental symmetry pool should be. And because if you're prepared to enlarge your pool, then you can always make a rare representation of the two properties. A rare representation of a group is always a proper representation of a slight enlargement of that group. And it's the enlargement of that group that does that is the so-called central extension. So for example, in the case that if you have a unitary representation group with a multiplier omega, the rare representation of the limit space, then consider the following larger group, which is given by that set. This is not a group theoretic Cartesian product, this is a set theoretic Cartesian product. So consider that set. And from that set, consider the following multiplication problem. A1 and U1 and G1 and G, calling this A1 and G2, are multiplied together in the following form. A1 times A2 times that set square, which is given by the multiplier. In the same slot, you just make G1 times G2 G2. Then you can define a proper representation of the Hilbert space by forming this u-bar of a comma g is equal to a times g. And you can prove from these laws, it's two-line proof, you can prove that this tree is a representation if u formally was a ray representation of one omega. So that extension by the symmetry group by one dimension, just if you attach this in one factor, can be made into a larger group, which is then properly represented. And that game can be played in a universal fashion. So for each group, there exists what's called the universal section, which is a G hat of G, by some abelian group A. And that abelian group may be larger than U1, or it may also be smaller sometimes. Such that, for any rare representation of G, you find a proper representation of G hat. So it depends on the group G how much you have to enlarge it. Sometimes very little, sometimes a lot. Okay, and that is just to say how this group G hat is built from the other groups. So let's say this group that you this abelian group that you have to add, that is the enlarging group, that lies as a normal subgroup of the group G hat, and your old symmetry group is a quotient. It's a quotient of G hat with respect to this abelian group A hat. And then you would, sometimes find statements like, okay, this G hat is the quantum symmetry proof, whereas G is the classical symmetry proof, and the A hat is the pure symmetry proof. This is really what you had to add on top of classical symmetries. And they would merge together in the classical symmetries in order to form this larger proof. And if you accept that, then you will also be special. This is the attitude taken by many people, for example, Stephen Weinberg's book, Quantum Field Theory, makes that one also. So, just two examples. For SL3, if G is SL3, then the universal central extension is, as I said, sometimes smaller, and it's SU2. So, we just have to add this little Z2 to G in order to get the universal central extension. So whenever you have a rare representation of SO3, you can find a proper representation of SU2. And if you believe that SU2 would then be the fundamental symmetry you were taught to do by quantum mechanics, then there's no way to derive the invariant superselection. So the invariant superselection will only result if you stick to SO3. So the question that you can then ask is, are all these group theory derivations of superselection rules merely based on the test of the prejudice for symmetry groups? So, and I may just wonder that you like the derivation of the invariant super selection from SR3. If you took SU2, you would
not have derived it. I forgot to mention this second.
The Galilei group also allows for non-triple central extensions, which is particular for the Galilei group, the point where which is sometimes called the Schrödinger group. And that's really an 11-dimensional group. You add really one-dimensional group, which is not U1, but it's R. It's sort of infinitely unfolded group. And if you add this R direction to the Schrödinger, to the Galilei group, your campus, as I said, sometimes called the Schrödinger group, that would then also not allow for this.
But it's 11 dimensions, one dimensional order.
And that's the point I make here. There's this so-called Bargmann superselection that you sometimes find in the books on quantum mechanics, for example, a book by Galim and Pasquale, talks about this. That you have mass superselection in non-relativistic mechanics. And that would vanish if, instead of the Galilei group, you took the group. And then you also can ask, what about charge superselection in 3D?
Which is slightly different. So let me talk about this example about the Bargmann superselection, which is interesting, because it highlights the reasoning that's made and that does not always make so much sense.
So consider, I mean, this is just a toy model, right? We know that Galilei group or Schrödinger group are not fundamental symmetry groups of our world. It's just to highlight the argument. Consider n particle Schrödinger equation with a Galilei invariant potential. The potential just depends on the relative distances. And consider particles with masses m1 to mn, and where smaller m without any base is just the sum of the masses. Let the Hilbert space of solutions be h of m. So if I indicate that the mass of the system as an index of the Hilbert space. On it, on the space of solutions, the Galilei group acts by rail representations. That's only from the mass. You know that you have to add the space factors. So if you multiply it, looks like this. So it's hardly really about you. So it's only of M, depending on the mass of the system. It's G of G1 and G2. These are two elements of the Galilei group. So an element of the Galilei group contains the velocity, a rotation, a spatial translation, and a time translation. And, so it should be G prime G. It's exponential I over H bar times the total mass. And then, so if the velocity belonging to the first entry, and the rotation belonging to the first times the spatial translation belonging to the second entry, and plus 1/2, and then the velocity boost belonging to that entry, times the time translation belonging to the second entry. There are various other ways of representing this space, but as I said, you can redefine it by this, but you can never make it to zero. It's a non-trivial, not similar to the Two of these multipliers are not similar amongst each other if and only if the total mass is different. For two different masses, they are not similar. And that imperfection I indicated before gives you a mass of the total mass. So you could not add states belonging to different total masses. But then you can ask, I would actually imply I never wanted to, because they belong to completely different systems. This is a system of masses, of n point masses with a certain total mass, and that's a different system with n point masses of a different total. Why should I add them? The only way I would ever get the idea to add them is if they are part of a common dynamical system of which mass is a dynamical variable. Otherwise, I would not know why I should ever add these things. They're not part of the same Hilbert space, never. So what you should do in that case, you should
design a dynamical model, perhaps already on the classical level, in which mass is a dynamical variable. And then reformulate the whole problem again. Which mass is a dynamical variable? And that can in fact be done quite easily if you can join all the masses and their conjugate variables to the dynamical system. And I call these conjugate variables lambda and the masses. They are playing now the role of the momenta, m. And you could just add these variables to your classical phase space. Consider the action in Hamiltonian form in human fashion by adding that factor. Momentum times velocity of the new variables. And keep the old Hamiltonian, which is a function of the mass, the x's and the p's, but the lambdas do not appear, they're cyclic variables. And that's a perfectly well-defined dynamical system. And what you should do is quantize that, and then ask the question, could you not superpose states of different total mass and volume? At least this is how I would understand it. And an inhibition of the superposition principle. Now that model is effective. Oops. It's in fact quite easy, as a classical dynamical system. If you add these variables, you take the Hamiltonian equation for your new variables. I said the added lambdas are cyclic variables, so the momenta are conserved. So that means the masses are conserved, and the old masses are just integration constants. So MI are just constants. You plug these constants into the equations for x and b, and then they become your old equations. And suppose you have been able to solve your old equations, then you also are able to solve the new equations, because they are now autonomous. I mean, they do not depend on M or lambda anymore. They depend on M, but they are constants. So you solve that equation, which is just your old equation. And then, after having done that, you set up the evolution equation for your new added configuration space variable, it's conjugate to mass, and then the Hamiltonian equation is that. But since now the x's and the p's have been solved as function of time in the second step, this equation can just be solved by quadrature. So the new equations do not pose a bigger dynamical problem than the old equations. They're basically equivalent. But the thinking is different because you have more observables. Now you can ask, what is classically speaking the symmetry proof of that dynamical system, in which mass is not dynamical? And the answer is, I prove that. The answer is, it's the Schwinger proof, not the Schwinger. The new system has the Schrödinger proof and the symmetry proof. And since it has the Schrödinger proof, and the Schrödinger proof is already the universal central extension, which doesn't allow for any more central extensions, no superselections appear anymore. So it's my understanding of that statement of the mass superselection is that it's actually based on sort of wrong starting point, because I never wanted to superpose states of separate systems which are not connected by dynamical variables. So in that case I would say I wouldn't believe the argument. Now let me briefly make some remarks about Schwarz's perspective. That's a very similar point of view. If you set up the classical equations for Maxwell, the classical Hamiltonian equations for Maxwell theory, allowing for charged configurations, that means long-range configurations, you must add variables at infinity in order to get stationary points at all. Relativists know this from asymptotic differential solutions of Einstein's equation, that you have to add certain boundary terms to represent energy, momentum, angular momentum. Without these boundary terms, you do not just get the wrong equations, you get no equations at all, because the action function would not be differentiable on that configuration which you like to have in the solution space, namely the long-range ones. The very same is true for electrodynamics. It is not correct to take a variation principle, derive the equations of motion, the Euler Lagrangian equations, and then admit solutions which were not originally in the space that you allowed in the variation principle. So we have to add, there's no choice, you have to add these boundary terms. And these boundary terms give you variables on the boundary, surface variables. They have to be added to your theory. And they correspond in the lecture, this in fact has been pointed out in quantum electrodynamics already in the 70s by Gervais and Zwanziger, starting with the infrared structure of QED. And in fact, I took all the notation from them. And so we have to add a whole function space worth of new variable fringe lambda and f, which are functions from the sphere at infinity into the real numbers. And people sometimes think that if you push the sphere to infinity, it's outside the physical universe. But it's exactly what is not true for long-dimensional configurations. You can never read of these degrees of freedom. So you have this function space worth of the variables. And you can either parameterize them by these functions from S2 to R, or you can take their components, at least with spherical harmonics, and then you get sort of discrete sets of new variables. And you can play the whole game of Hamiltonian reduction and Hamiltonian equation of motion and constraints and so forth. And what you find that the Gauss constraint now has bulk piece and a surface piece. The bulk piece is as usual, and the surface piece is the following, that's the Schrödinger picture. That the derivative of the Schrödinger function, or functional, with respect to the newly added configuration variable, is a certain operator acting on psi, and the operator is just the multi-component of the normal component of E, the flux component of E. So it's the flux distribution that's measured by this new variables. The flux distribution at infinity. In particular, the monopole flux. That means it's just not the total flux, the amount of flux that goes to infinity. It's measured by the variable lambda 0,0. So lambda 0,0 is something like the goal of things. So that's the idea. In particular, so that's the charge operator acting on the Schrödinger function, some constant, times the derivative of lambda 0,0, one of these infinite set of new variables that you're operating on your side. So then the charge of the selection rules amounts to the statement that for some reason the operator, the space, the rotation operator, for this particular variable, lambda 0,0, is not part of any bounded function thereof, because I'm bounded in the operator. It's not part of your algebraic observables. Because then, if this is not part of your algebraic observables, its commutative variable, which is just Q, commutes with everything. It's the existence of lambda 0,0 that would usually make Q not commute with everything. But if you remove it, Q commutes with everything, like in the center and defines the superselective. So that suggests that even though the classical theory leaves no doubt on the about the existence of that variable, that degree of freedom at infinity, the quantum theory proves somehow neglect that degree of freedom. And it's clear how they do it. It's a mechanical requirement, I would say, neglect that degree of freedom. It's you build your algebra of observables by some limit of observables smeared with test functions of compact support. Then you take some limit by pushing this support to infinity. But that algebra, like that element, lambda 0,0 is always outside, so you never reach it. So it's that locality requirement that imposes the supersymmetric rule, and not a sort of theoretical necessity. And you can make a statement differently. You can say global phase change is a real physical meaningful symmetry and not a gauge redundancy, which is different. So it rotates in an existing degree of freedom rather than telling you that this degree of freedom doesn't exist. And it's obvious why it must be. Because Q is the conjugate momentum to it. So if Q is non-zero, the momentum in this direction is non-zero, then this direction obviously exists to it. It's not a redundancy. Okay, so that brings me to the end of talk. So there's a debate going on, and I think we will hear a lot about it in the course of this conference, about the existence and non-existence of superselection rules. They are theories resting on certain hypotheses, but sometimes the hypotheses are sort of debatable. And let me just make two statements. by two very different kinds of approach. People pursue very different approaches. In 1989, Weidman, who was certainly one of the algebraic field theory developers, made the following statement in a paper reviewing the status of superselectivity. He's saying that the theoretical results currently available fall into two categories: rigorous results and approximate models, and approximate models and realistic models. And then I think that's quite a question statement about the situations. And then there is some issue that relates to the topic of this conference, namely reference frames, which are neglected. In all these variables that I introduced, lambda, all refer to some reference frame in which you describe the system. And this reference frame has always been assumed to be absolute, not being reacted upon by the system. And this neglection is stated, is believed by some people to be purely responsible for this apparent superselectivity. But if you take into account, all superselectivity should disappear, or at least most of them, in the right intervention frame. And one of these, is Norman, 1977 said the following: superselection rules do not exist. The belief of 3 times W is wrong because the basic assumption about physics is incorrect. Different observers can disagree on whether two states occur at coherently superposed. And this is, but what he assumes is that the reference frame can itself share superposition of states, can itself be a superposition of states. So if you refer to your system from an observer that himself is in the superposition, for example, of charged states, then of course he sees also superpositions. But the very question is whether you can have such observers. And this is what I said here, knowing the possibility of reference frames to coherent superpositions of the quantity in question. And this has been debated before by Aronoff and Suski in 1967, who also said superselection rules do not exist because of that neglection of the position states. Okay, I want to thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions.
I think it depends on what superselection rule one is talking about. I mean, I think the experimental status of the, for example, the charge superselection rule, it's definitely that it's there. And I do not know of any experiment that would say floating charge state in this universe.
You didn't
solve
that
There's lots of experiments on superselection rules in molecules. That's true. But they do not fall into this class of having strict proof by symmetry principles. And they are possibly called superselection rules. They're more like selection rules, sort of hard selection rules.
So did I understand you correctly that if you wanted to prove a superselection rule for univalence, then you have to assume that the sort of fundamental underlying symmetry is SO3 and not SU2.
Yes.
And if you assume the latter, then that superselection rule disappears. Mm-hmm.
Nuclear physics and particle physics textbooks have the shocking practice that they introduce SU2 and SU3 group transformations, leading to superposition of different electric charges, and they do it without any detailed explanation. They tell you that there is an approximate symmetry between neutron and proton.
Yes.
So you can introduce an SU2 rotation in a complex space between the two. So you can ignore charge superselection. This provided the audience has any knowledge of this typical nuclear physicist stuff. Can you comment on this?
I think it's not meant to say that you actually can observe these superposition states. I mean, if you either observe a neutron or a proton,
I don't think that it's meant to say that even though you can rotate these vectors into each other, you observe the superposition. But I mean, you have to go to look what they exactly say. But that's my understanding. I mean, the superselection rule does not mean that you cannot add the vectors as mathematical objects. Of course, you can do this. But the superselection rule then says that if you have such a diagonal vector, with respect to the observations that you made, it looks like a mistake. It doesn't look like you cannot see the coherence. You just see a mixture.
Two comments. The first is that people that actually don't use superconductors, we already by then turn to perceptions. So look like a different information using super pairs of superconductors and so on. They do it in a way much like Aaron or Susskind happens by having coherently shared problems in general. So you know, the experimental says that I'm not sure if anyone's raising that terms. They have been experimentally demonstrated. The second point is, I think you unfairly paraphrase Merman there, because he doesn't say that the observer has to find the superselection. In fact, in those constructions, the conservation law is still rigorously satisfied. The conservation law from which the superselection law was presupposed. It's just that whatever the conserved quantity is being shared coherently between different subsystems of the universe. And so it's unfair to sort of say that, well, if the observer is violating superstructural, then of course the system is just not what's happening. The same operationally, you see all the operational signatures of coherence. It's just that you sort of spray down the sort of total charge, for example, amongst different subsystems. In a way that's entangled, and back then, I think they thought maybe that they would have to be entangled systems, but you know that they don't have to. They could be in sort of mixed states, which coherently share this stuff, and it doesn't even have to be entangled, because it might be more
intangible. I don't quite understand, but let me just propose a first comment on
superconductors.
I think, yes, I know that experiment. But I think it's very important that you, I mean, there are different notions of charge states, locally charged and globally charged. And the charge superselection, the proof of charge superselection is just global charge. The proof by Strachan and Weitmann is global charge. You might question whether this is, the proof is correct, but you might question whether it's relevant. Because aren't we always just looking at local charges, locally charged states? And that, I think, is a fair criticism. But I think it doesn't contradict anything that I said, because I was referring to this global charge, and this where Riemann's proofs exist. And the Merman statement, I'm not so sure about. I mean, we had a debate about this. But there were some replies by Wigner and Hegefeld on precisely that point.
Yeah, but they completely misunderstood it. And I think apparently it was us in their minds there.
I know.
We never misunderstood.
But each part said they were misunderstood. I mean,
but I think it's obvious that anyone who reads the Hermann of Sussman paper, they were satisfying the conservation.
Well, that may even be this particular discussion, poorly discussion. Was there one question? No. Well, that was good. All right, okay, final question.
So, okay, both of these formulations that Weitmann, we said it was, where it's approximate theorems on absolute proofs or proof theorems on approximates, proofs leave open the possibility, of course, that the superselection rule is violated, say at high energy or something like that. But what if you formulate the whole thing the other way around? Say the superselection rule is sacrosanct, it's the axiom, and then you end up saying the symmetries are only approximate. Does anybody try to think of it that way? Seems like the obvious thing to attempt.
So it's just the superselection rule should be an axiom, and you want to change it. Why then do you want to change the symmetry group?
Well, because the proof is only approximate, or the symmetry group was only approximate to begin with. I'm just turning it around.
I don't think that's considered to be a very attractive position, because violating the superposition principle on top of quantum, first starting quantum mechanics with the superposition principle and then introducing ad hoc inhibitions
Well, but don't first introduce the superposition principle. First introduce the super selection, then go backwards.
I don't know whether anybody listens to this.
Okay. Well, let's thank Mr. Poe again. We'll reconvene at 11:05.
Thank you.